So would you mind introducing yourself for the audience, please?
Sure. Hi, my name is Jenity Page. I'm a professional oil painter. I've been painting about 20 years. I'm also a mother. I've had four children. And I also compete on a show in America called American Ninja Warrior. It's like an obstacle course reality TV show, and they call me the art
That's amazing. I love that. And I've been
ninja.
reading your bio, and one of the things I find fascinating is how you can find time to be a mother and an artist, and not only a mother and an artist, but a kind of an athlete as well, to make you a ninja. I've seen it's been for quite a while you've been into fitness, because I saw in 2017 that you and your husband were taking a bike ride, and you had a painting of someone holding a lot of weights. I don't know if it was a self-portrait. So how do you find the time to, I mean, you're painting currently whilst we're doing the podcast. If we weren't on the podcast, how do you fit it in?
Well, I'll tell you what. I actually came at art with very little talent. So when I started in college, I realized how much time I had to make up for. I didn't decide to pursue art until my last year of high school. So, I felt like I was going to school with all these kids that knew from the time they were five that they were going to be painters. And because of that lack of experience, I thought, well, what am I going to do? Well, like the school opened at 4 o'clock for the janitors to come in and clean. And so I would just go to the studio at 4 and paint really early, and then classes start at 8, and then I'd be at school all day. And then I would go to bed early, which when you're in college, is really not cool. All my roommates would be just getting the party started at like 9 o'clock, and I'd be like, I'm going to bed. And so that pattern of like going to bed early and waking up early is also how I managed to do art while being a mom and having young children, because I could paint while they were sleeping. So I just kind of like made a goal once I started having kids that I would paint as much as I could before they woke up. And then anytime I got during the day, like if they happened to nap, or if they were, at a play date or something, that time was just bonus. But I really use that time like very focused, because I knew and I was only going to get so many hours. And it's kind of funny because I look at my life and like my time before I was a parent, I wasted so much time because I had it, right? And one of my favorite painters, his name is David Kassin. And one thing that he said in a workshop I took with him is that if you have the time, you'll use it. So whether you have a large quantity of time or not a lot of time, either way, you're going to use the time. And so I find by actually having limited time as a parent, and now also as an athlete, it makes it so that when I am painting, it's like a super focused experience.
That's incredible. I mean, when I'm curious as well, now that you say that you started as not especially talented at art when you were younger. So what is it that gave you that interest in art if it wasn't natural to you at the time?
Okay, that's a good question. So, growing up, I was a musician. I was a pianist, and I was a very driven and focused kid. So I would practice at least an hour a day, and then as I got older and got into, harder music, I would paint. So I would practice sometimes 3 hours a day. And so that's what I thought I was going to be, a pianist growing up. And then I was also very academic. I wanted to get a full ride to college. I wanted to graduate at the top of my class. And so that was like my focus. Well, then what happened was we moved. We were living in a state called Utah, and we moved to a different state my last year of high school, which was so dramatic for me. You just build this whole world and this whole experience, and then that whole world is shattered. Well, we moved from a very highly populated area with a very large school to a very small rural community in a state called Colorado. And I go to sign up for classes at my new school, and I tell the counselor, "Hey, I want to be valedictorian. I want a full ride to college. So I need to give me, I want all your honors classes and then your advanced placement classes." And she just looked at me and she was like, "Oh, sweetheart, we actually don't do any of that here." I was like, what? So what am I gonna do with my senior year? And I had always loved like coloring and coloring books. Huge Crayola fan. So it wasn't like, I guess art wasn't at all a part of my life. It just wasn't a focus, and I wasn't painting and sketching all the time, you know. So I just thought, hey, you know, art will be fun. I guess I'll take art. And then it was crazy because at this, it was a tiny school. So there was just like one teacher that was the whole art department. And she had just graduated from college. So she was this young kid, honestly. And she introduced art to me in a very interesting way. She said, she wanted us to keep an art journal. And instead of writing about our experiences every day, she wanted us to create art or an image about what we were experiencing. And being a, you know, 17-year-old girl that had just been ripped out of her state and placed somewhere else, like I had all the emotions, I had all the things that I was trying to work through. And so I used this process of art journaling as a way to deal. And I couldn't draw, so most of it is like collage work. Like I take magazines, cut them up, glitter glue, leaves, found objects, more like scrap, I guess. To kind of collage images. And then when I did draw, it was pretty rudimentary. Like my people are either stick figures or they're like little rectangles with circular, with like a circle for a head. But that process of just taking what I felt and putting it into an image, like it lit my soul on fire. And so it was funny because, you know, here I've been on this like super academic trajectory. And then like I go to my mom one day and I was like, oh, Mom, I'm gonna be an artist. And she was like, are you sure? You know, because she's seeing the work that I'm doing and is like, not sure that's gonna cut it. But I was like, no, like literally, I've never loved anything more. And it's kind of interesting because my mom taught me to journal when I was like 10 years old. And so I had kept a written journal since I was 10. And so I feel like it was kind of beautiful that art was introduced to me in a form that was so relevant to me, something that I already loved. So yeah, it was art's ability to communicate feeling that made me want to pursue it.
That's beautiful. I love that. Now, I've been to Utah. I love it. It was gorgeous. I went to Salt Lake City. It was a stunning, amazing place. And I've been to Colorado. I've been quite a few places in America, and they're amazing, beautiful states, both of them. Now,
Thank you.
did you try out landscape at all? Because obviously your main painting is figures and these amazing scenes that you depict. Was there ever a time where you thought, this landscape is just so gorgeous, see if I can capture that in paint, or did that never appeal to you?
That's a good question. I did try landscape a little bit. I think it's part of everybody's like painting education. I painted like the Colorado mountains behind my home when I was in college. But I think for me, it's like the thing I'm most interested in is the human experience. And something endlessly fascinating to me about painting people. And I just think where I'm always trying to communicate a message, a story, an idea. And you can do that with landscapes. But I just found that people, I could say what I wanted to say easier with people than I could with plants and mountains. So,
Now, it's a long road from rectangles and circles to what you're doing now. So it was there, I mean, I know that you've said you've got a lot of mentors and kind of people who you've done workshops with on the way up. So was there any specific workshop or mentor or, you know, as you were learning, who really gave you the knowledge of form and perspective that you obviously apply now to your work?
Yeah, for sure. I feel like I'm the product of my art education. I will say I feel like I have to address something though, because this is a very important part of my story. And if I don't share it, I feel like it won't be like a complete truth. And that is, you know, I get to college and I'm so excited to express myself in art and learn this subject. And it's the first day of freshman orientation, and I'm in this big hall and they're doing a PowerPoint presentation where they're showing previous student work, students that have recently graduated. And it was there sitting in that auditorium that I really realized I had no talent. It was there that it like really hit me, you know, because like when you're at a small school in a rural community and there's not really anybody to compare you against, and you're also there's no social media at this point, you know, you think that you can do things, you know, maybe you think more of yourself than you what talent you really have. So compared to the talent pool that I was in, I was like, oh yeah, I can do this. I can learn to be an artist. Well, then I get to school and I see what actual, you know, quality college level work looks like. And I was overwhelmed and just started crying because these kids were amazing. Like they were creating beautiful work. And I'm thinking of my little hodgepodge journal. I'm thinking of my little stickers and thinking, oh no, this isn't it. Like I got to pick a different major. Like I can't do this. And so I left that meeting and I was in tears. I was crying because I was just like, I loved it so much, you know, and I felt like something inside me was dying as I like walked away from this building because I had fallen in love with art so much. And as I'm crossing this street to my apartment, all of a sudden I had this feeling, like this thought, and it was, Jenity, you can be an artist. And you know, I'm a very religious person, and I felt God kind of, you know, stop me and be like, hey, you can do this. And I was like, are you sure? Have you seen my work? It is so bad. Like, how could I possibly ever do this? And as I kind of offered that question up to the heavens, I just felt God tell me that he would help me. And I, you know, part of my journaling from the time I was 10 was for spiritual reasons. You know, it's like take questions I had to God or questions about my life. And so I kind of felt like I'd kind of developed this relationship with him during that time. And so when I get to college and he tells me that he can help me, like I totally believed him. And so then I would go to school at 4 in the morning, and the very first thing I would do is I would offer a prayer and just remind him, like, God, we both know what I am capable of. And you promised help, and this is me inviting you to be a part of this experience and to help me learn and to help me paint. And so it was like very much like a almost like a religious practice, seeking help beyond myself to do the work. That being said, I also had some really phenomenal teachers. So I studied with a man named Leon Parson, who's, I mean, if you look up his work, oh my gosh, like he is a tight realist and perfectionist, and he was the perfect teacher for me, I think, like as an academic girl. I mean, he just had a real way of kind of showing me the science of art. You know, when I learned about perspective and human form and the golden mean and all that, I was like, this is math. Like, proportion is math. Like, how come nobody told me that I can use math to become a good painter, because I was good at math, you know? So that was kind of beautiful and eye-opening. And then also just like I felt like and then another mentor of mine, his name was Wade Huntsman, he was actually an illustrator for or an animator with DreamWorks, which is a made a lot of children's films here in the States. And both Wade Huntsman and Leon Parson, like had a very high bar of excellence that they demanded from their students. And then on top of that, I had academic scholarship. Like I had to get A's in my classes in order to keep my school paid for, which was so terrifying to me because as an academic, I was trained to memorize information and take tests. I was really good at writing papers. And then suddenly I'm in this environment where it's like, no, you're going to sit on this drawing horse for 2.5 hours with a live model. At the end of 2.5 hours, you're going to turn in your drawing and that's your grade. Like that was terrifying to me, which is why I prayed a lot in college. but I think that both of those men had such a high quality of work, that they set like a really high bar for me. And then when I graduated, I had a professor who told me, he's like, Jenny, you have a 4-year degree. Congratulations, you got a bachelor's degree. And he's like, but this is like the tip of the iceberg. Like this is like the very beginning of your education. And I need you to go find artists that you admire and then take workshops with them and like continue learning because there's just still so much for you to learn. And so I graduated, my husband and I moved to the Los Angeles area in California, and I was poor, like super poor. So for a while, I couldn't afford to take lessons from anybody, but I paid it a lot. And then as soon as I could, like as soon as I started selling more work, I just set aside a little bit of money each year to take a workshop every year with somebody. And so I've had the opportunity to study with like Casey Child, and I mentioned David Kassin and Casey Childs. All these guys are kind of like well known in like the Portrait Society of America realm here in the United States. And then it wasn't until 2017 that I was invited to study with William Whitaker, who is another realist that I admired. I actually saw one of his originals when I was in college and had to like pick my jaw up off the floor because it was like the level of finish on this painting was just remarkable. And I actually ran into him at an Oil Painters of America conference, and he invited me to come study with him full time. So I like essentially had an apprenticeship with William Whitaker, and that like changed my life. I feel like I learned how to paint a pretty traditional approach. It's like, oil in your drawing and then like, mark out like kind of block in your darks, block in your lights, block in your half tones, and then start bridging, like going from there. And William Whitaker painted completely different, and he kind of just was like, throw away everything that you've ever been taught and like let's start over. He would just I mean, at this point I had already been painting, for over 10 years, and he would just have he's like, no, that's not it. That's not it. Dandy, stop. No, just sit and watch me. Okay, sit and watch me. And yeah, so I've been painting like him ever since, and he I would say was like the biggest influence in my art.
That's fantastic. I love that. Now, I don't know if you've heard of the artist C.W. Mundy. He's a big deal artist himself, and he spoke of his spirituality when I spoke to him and how much it influences his journey and his sensibilities through art making. And when he teaches, he has some interesting approaches to how to communicate certain things to his students as well. One of the biggest ones that I remembered him saying is, when he would see a student's work, he would ask the whole class, does this need a bulldozer, a truck driver, or brain surgery? So does it need completely knocking down? Does it need a bit of roughing up to kind of give it some life? Or does it need just tiny little touches here and there, really precise to finish it off? And he'd say that after a while, they wouldn't get it at first, but after a while, they would understand the system of what the piece needed in order to just serve the work, really, beyond anything precious that the artist would initially or the student would initially attach to the work. He would try to help them disassociate from their initial connection to their own work so that they can really prepare to disrupt whatever they've already painted to get somewhere different than what they would do without his assistance. Is that something which you experienced with? Was it Wayne you said last? Was the
Oh, William.
William, sorry.
William Whitaker.
William Whitaker. Was that similar with him? Where not exactly the same, but I mean, was it different enough where it would be a completely different system of constructing a painting than what you were used to? Because you were saying about blocking the darks, blocking the lights, blocking your midtones, and then start to blend with the nuances and subtleties in between. Was it different enough where you thought this is now a completely different school of thought and you'd have to have to step back from your built knowledge that you'd already earned.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is why he would kept telling me, like, no, that's not it. Okay, sit back, watch. So it was interesting because he did most of his paintings with really small brushes, you know, and it was like I was always taught, oh, use the biggest brush that you can, and big to small, and William was almost like just putting in these little marks and weaving them together. And what he would say, you know, is he's got an arm that he's working on. And he was like, Jendy, look at all those colors in that arm. Okay. And it's not like it's all just tan. You know, it's like that's how you make like a plastic looking arm. He's like, our bodies are layered, right? You've got bone and muscle and tissue and veins, and then you've got like this thin wrapping of the epidermis that goes around it. And we're trying to capture like all this information. And he's like, I think it's kind of impossible to do it in one go. And so he was like, when you're painting, I want you to look for all the color that you can, like blue, purple, pink. And he's like, and on your first layer, like for sure, like accentuate the color that you see. Like if you think something kind of leans blue, put some blue in there. And if you think it has, and he would, there was a lot of variety in these little marks that he was putting down, but it was almost like he was weaving the skin together. And as I looked down at my arm and I looked at these skin cells, I was like, oh my gosh, my skin is kind of woven together. And he wouldn't do a lot of blending, which is crazy. Like if you've seen the work of William Whittaker, you will be like, no, for sure the man blended. But listen, he would just put in these tiny little marks, and then he would like put down a mark and leave it, put down a mark and leave it. And then he would let it dry, and then he would come back with a razor blade like this. And once it would dry, he would scrape it. And what that was doing is that in his method was essentially impressionistic, right? He's just like putting down marks of color and leaving it, very impressionistic. But in doing so, you create all of these ridges from where the paint, you know, remains from the stroke. And so the scraping takes off all that texture, and you're only left with visual texture of these little colors and these little marks all kind of weaving together. And then he would do the second layer. And the second layer, very similar approach with the small brushes. This time he's bridging gaps and he's refining the information. And let it dry, do the same thing, scrape it, and then another layer. And each layer he's growing in refinement. And then when he got to the end, instead of using a scraping tool, he'd maybe use like a really fine sandpaper, until it was like literally like a glass surface. And when I learned this, I couldn't believe it, because having seen his work, and I was like, Bill, everybody thinks that you're this tight realist, bro. You're an impressionist painter. You just like bring it all together, you know? So I wonder if I can turn my camera, because I'm actually painting right now on something. Do you know if I can flip this?
You should be able to. Is it an iPad?
Oh yeah, it's actually my laptop, so we'll see this. Okay.
Oh, okay.
So I'm
Yeah.
working on these hands right now. I'm going to try to get you up close, but
Yeah.
if you look up close, you can see like purple, green, pink, orange, you know?
Yeah.
And even right now, like I'm working all the way down
Oh, wow.
here. I wonder if I can like hold my camera and paint for you. Let's see. We'll try. Okay. So he does these little marks like this. Okay.
Yeah.
And with a little bit of green or a little bit of purple. And he would actually like encourage me to use as much color variety as I could, because he would be like, Jenny, you should start with as much color as you want, because we can always dial it back, right? But if you start too neutral, sometimes it can be hard to breathe all that life and that color in. And then the secret sauce in this, I call it the Whittaker method, is at the very end, your last layer, whenever you decide that is. Sometimes I'll do 3 layers, sometimes I'll do four. Honestly, when I was working with him, I think one of the things that helped me progress the most is I would take a painting as far as I thought, like, oh, this painting is done. And then I would bring it to him and he'd be like, Jenny, this is a perfectly good painting. You're doing a wonderful job. Just needs like one more layer or like the whole thing, you know? And you're like, wait, what? Wait, I have to paint the whole thing again? And in his last layer, he would use lead white. We actually love the best Michael Harding stack lead white, which Michael is not currently producing. Michael produce it in the future. So right now I'm using Rublev and then this Old Masters Merojé medium. Okay, so a little bit of this. And lead white is really fascinating because especially the best is Michael Harding's, but this one isn't too bad either. It's like really ropey. It's almost like stringy, you know, and it's really thick. So you pour this out and then we put a little bit of this Flemish Merojé to thin it out, and then he would paint his whole last layer in lead white, no titanium. And what it would do is it just would like create this, because it's transparent, you don't lose all of those color web that you've created under the surface, and now you just get to like put this veil over it. This softens it and kind of like brings it all together. So it's a very time-consuming process. But yeah, like was able to create awesome work with it. Like this piece I painted in his studio with partially from a photo and then partially from a live model. This painting is called Coming Full Circle. And this, like, if you look up close at the fabric, you can see those tiny little marks. And this is how I painted this piece is through that method. So
It's absolutely beautiful. For the audio listeners, you can see brush strokes that aren't tiny. They're not as small as I imagine. They're actually, like you said, almost Van Gogh-like impressionist. This is on the one which you just showed us a moment ago, not the full circle painting. And whereas on the full circle painting, these are beautiful kind of textural marks that speak to the fabric, and really it's what gives so much life to your painting. And it's fantastic, absolutely wonderful, wonderful work. I love it. And I've been watching the reels of you talking about the light that you're currently painting on the canvas and how you save the white for the lightest light and you tone everything else down with the illusion of it being white without it truly being white. Is that something which you learned earlier on, or is that a similar time frame where you started to learn about the tonal values and how you can manipulate people's understanding of how they read these lights?
That was actually part of my education in college with Leon Parson. He was master, still is a master artist. And it blew my mind when he taught me about value, and he would tell me that value is king. And we actually did an arbitrary painting project in college where we were told to use whatever color we wanted, didn't matter. Color was not important, but value was. And he's like, what's so amazing is you can use whatever color. You could paint a face purple, pink, orange, blue, but if your value is right and if your value is correct and it's in the right places, it will read as a face, you know? And I was like, as you know, as a kid, I was just like, oh my gosh, what? That's amazing, you know? And I think growing up, I think most artists start with maybe drawing graphite on paper, right? And so he would say, like, for example, if you're going to draw a face, pay attention on your reference or your model, whatever you're using, where is the lightest part? You know, and in most instances, you know, I'm just like looking in this camera, you know, and I can see very few places on your face that are actually like white, right? He's like, that is the only place you can leave paper. Everywhere else has to be darker in value. And that also blew my mind because, like, I remember, you know, little drawing projects here and there growing up, and you would just like shade, like, you know, just like, oh, just like this little dark shadow right here, or just like under the chin or like just above the eye, and then everything else would be like white paper, you know? And so, yeah, like learning it, I teach pretty frequently, and I tell all of my students, yeah, value is king. You have to pay attention to that. If that is the lightest light, that's your only white, and nothing else can be white. Otherwise, you lose the illusion. So, yeah.
That's amazing. And then the arbitrary painting being the using the different colors or whatever color it is, so long as the tonal values read as accurate. Does this mean that did that help facilitate an understanding of the warms and cools of the colors in the more accurate painting that you do now because of that experimentation, or did it not relate so much?
I think it was definitely important to kind of like take that. I think as you go in as like a young kid, that you think trees are green and hair is this, you know, like, and you think if everything is like one color, you know. And so I think for sure it kind of helped expand my mind that that you can use more than just what you think that color is to say. To represent a color, you can use multiple colors to represent a color, you know. But I think it's been in my experience of painting for so long that I've started to see color better. And this is something really interesting is that, like, I think growing up, I used to think that the best painters were the ones that could do this the best, you know, like the hand coordination. And I'm learning that actually it's the ones that can see the best. And that if you can't see it, you can't paint it. I mean, I remember doing like my first landscape. We talked about I did these Colorado mountains, and my professor Leon Parson, he comes up to me and he was like, "Jenity, I want you to do me a favor. Go back into your mind the night you were at your back porch in your home in Colorado, and you took that picture of those mountains. Were they actually that dark?" And you're like, "What are you talking about, bro? I've got this reference right here. This camera right here is telling me, yes, the mountains were that dark." And he was like, "Okay, sweetheart, I'm telling you right now, they were not. That cameras offer distortion, and the cameras will compress values, and they were probably lighter than that." And when he said that, I was like, "You mean, what are you saying? You're saying like photography doesn't represent the best picture of reality? What?" You know? So yeah, like just like learning then, okay, so sometimes photography isn't totally accurate. And then, but learning to see like that, like he saw as an artist, like he saw mountains and he like logged in his brain, "Oh, they're actually this beautiful like blue violet," you know? And so I think as you paint, you retrain your eyes to see. And so I think that that's been a big part of my painting process. I think, you know, I had some friends over here at the studio and I was working on these arms and they're like, "Oh my gosh, Jenny, you're using green and purple and red." And I was like, "Yeah, don't you see it?" And they're like, "Actually, I just see an arm. I just see skin. That's amazing that you see all that." And I think it's because I've just, you know, you see what you look for. And it's just been long enough that now I just see, I think, color in a new way.
That's brilliant. That is brilliant. And it's very true. I've been fortunate enough to have very kind mentors myself to teach me about seeing things and looking at things keenly, but also seeing through what you see in order to not focus on the details too soon when you're painting, because that can be an issue when you're learning as well. So yeah,
Right.
that's wonderful. And do you have a set color palette? And if so, what colors are on your set color palette?
Well, I don't want to say it's like, you know, set, because it's, I feel like probably everybody's palette is evolving all the time. I feel like every time I go to a new like painting conference, or I remember seeing Adrian Stein, you know, Adrian Stein's work.
I don't know. I will be
Girl
looking it
can
up for
paint.
this
Yeah,
conversation.
girl can paint. Talk about color. Adrian Stein. Oh my gosh. Okay. But when I saw her palette, I was like, I think we could add some more colors. And I feel like, you know, I think when you're learning, so important to have like just rein it in, just like keep it simple. You know, I was taught in a very limited palette. And I've actually experimented a little bit with limited palettes too. Like I once did a figure, like a portrait piece, where I only used phthalo green lake by Michael Harding, and alizarin crimson and green gold by
Wow.
Michael Harding, and those three in white, and I did like a whole painting. So I think it's fun to always be like kind of exploratory a little bit. But I mean, since we're here, I'll show you.
I just want to take a minute to talk about the patrons for Painting Insights podcast. They are fantastic support for the podcast, the reason it's still going as well. But I also want to mention that every month we host a bonus show to our Patreon channel. And recently I was fortunate enough to spend the day out with Rob Poynton as he painted one of the landscape paintings that he made in North Wales in 2025. And I joined him on a day when it was quite stormy weather. He said it was some of the worst weather conditions he's painted in, and I managed to capture that on camera. It may sound awful, but it was quite a privilege to see how he does what he does in those conditions. If you're interested in that story, that will be exclusive to Patreon. So I highly recommend checking it out. It's the price of a cup of coffee, and it means the world to Richard and I for supporting the podcast. I really genuinely want to thank everyone for watching, liking, commenting, subscribing, but especially to the patrons. They really do prop us up and keep us going. So if you can check it out, the link will be in the description below.
So I got titanium, I got alizarin. Alizarin and cad red light are kind of like old standbys that are always here. Because I'm doing the light bulb painting, I added cad orange just to, give me a little more variety there. And I also have a cad yellow. This is, I don't even know what this is. Maybe it's yellow ochre. This one I don't really use very much. It's just been, this guy's just been hanging out here for a little bit. Okay, green gold by Michael Harding is one of my favorite colors of all time. I use it all the time. I think it's like one of my go-to green gold for blonde hair. And then olive green, that's a recent addition. And then I've got phthalo green. So here I've got like two really warms, a light value, like yellow leaning warm green, and then a darker warm green, both very transparent. I really recommend high transparency colors. They just mix so much better. And then phthalo green, which we all know will take over any painting at any time. So proceed with caution. Okay. Then I have King Blue Light. I have it in two different brands, which is why it looks like two different colors. I was just playing with those today to see which one I like better. Cerulean, Ultramarine Blue, Red Iron Oxide by Michael Harding. I used to use Burnt Sienna. Like Burnt Sienna was on there all the time. And then I started using transparent red iron oxide, which is like burnt sienna, but transparent. Like it's so much better because transparent. Okay. And then raw umber and Payne's gray. So there you go.
That's an amazing palette. And
Kind of. Yeah.
go on, kind of what, sorry.
Oh, it's actually kind of a lot compared to, where I started, but that's what I said. Like, I feel like my palette's kind of always expanding. It also depends on like what I'm painting. So,
Well, my next question will be about where it started, but for the first thing I need to follow up on is what are the two brands of King's Blue Light that are competing for your affection currently?
Michael Harding, because love Michael Harding. Do you use Michael Harding paint?
Absolutely, I do, yeah.
Yeah, because I mean he's over there. He's in your neck of the woods.
I wish you were
Such a nice
closer, but
guy.
yeah.
I know. And then I use M. Graham quite a bit. I think, M. Graham was kind of the paint that I started with in college, and so it still has a place in my heart. But Michael Harding, man, his paints are so good. So
So, out of the two King's Blue Lights, which is the lighter of the two? Or not lighter, but what's the difference between the two, I should ask?
yeah, well, because of Michael Harding, it just has more pigment. It's just like a p more powerful blue, Obviously, the lesser expensive paint, Lim Gram is a slightly less expensive paint compared to Michael Harding. It just has less pigment. But sometimes it's kind of a good thing, which is why I put them there. Because I've got like, dude, I've got the craziest color shifts happening in the background of this lipo piece. Like this, like just so subtle. You're like, okay, it was warm around the light bulb, and eventually over here we get to like a bluish purple, but like in between, there's all these like really subtle shifts that happen. And so I was thinking that maybe today I would try. Maybe less pigment isn't always the best because I want it to gray a little bit more. I don't want it to be so like, well, bam, you know? So,
Fantastic.
yeah.
When was it you discovered the green gold?
Oh, you know, I think it was at like a portrait society conference in Washington, D.C. I want to say it was recommended to me there by somebody. And then it was funny because this is how it goes in painting conferences is like you're sitting, everybody's taking notes. Everybody wants to know the secret sauce, you know, like you go and listen to all these fantastic painters, and as soon as they start listing off what colors they use, you know, everybody's like feverishly like writing it down. And I think I can't remember who it was, honestly, at this point, but somebody was like green gold, and then like everybody like rushes, you know, to the Michael Harding booth, and Michael Harding's like, thank you, you know, and we all like buy out all of the green gold. And but no, it is literally is one of my favorite colors because it's this really kind of like kind of like a baby poop green, you know, it's like a warm, yellowy, transparent green. But it's also, so I use it in like I said, blonde hair is like basically green gold. But then also like in making skin tone, I feel like one of the biggest challenges in skin tone is like it's a warm, but it's not too warm. You know, it's like, yeah, we might start with cad red or red iron oxide and some white to make like a pinkish color. And here I am talking obviously about Caucasian skin. It's a whole different ball game with other ethnicities. But then you go into like cool it, like, okay, it's too warm. Okay, so we're gonna need to, what do we do? Use the complement. We're gonna use the complement. We're gonna cool it down. And then it's always like, whoa, now it's too cold. You know, and I feel like this is what color mixing is. It's like, okay, it's warm. Okay, too warm. A little bit of cold. Too cold. Way too cold. More warm. Wow, it's way too warm. And so you start to appreciate colors that like are a little more subtle. Like Terra Verde by Michael Harding is also like in this realm of like little subtle green. So anyways. Yeah, so that's why I like green cold.
That's wonderful. That is wonderful. Now, I'd like to know where your palette came from since it's ended up so kind of. It's sort of got a split of primary, but it's also got in your cadmium orange, which is not unpopular. It's something which I hear from a lot of artists because it can be a shortcut color just so that you don't have to mix it every time. And it can be such a just a good thing for colors that you need in things. Like I've heard that in what was it now? Was it in oak, interior oak? I've heard from one artist who said that I'm sure it was interior. No, not oak. Might be pine, interior pine. It was one of the woods where he said for interiors, wood has yellow, has orange, cadmium orange. But yeah, I
I
can't
believe it.
remember which one it is now. I'll have to go back and revisit that episode because I talked to so many artists. But that's something which I hear quite often. So where has your palette come from before it developed all of these nuanced colors?
You know, because it's like I learned how to paint in college, and you know, it was in college when my mind was exploded when I was in class, and my professor was like, I know, maybe growing up you heard that there were warm colors and cool colors. That like red, orange, yellow, those were the warm colors. And green, blue, purple, those were the cold colors. That was a lie. You can have warm and cold of any color. He's like, take a banana. You go to the grocery store, it's not very ripe, it's a very cold yellow. And then you watch it ripen on your counter and it's going to become a very warm yellow. And that's when my mind exploded. I have been lied to my whole life. There's a cold yellow. So that, I mean, that was the beginning, I think, of my color education. And then my teacher, I think our, you know, our palette, my palette in college was like a cad red light and alizarin. So you've got like a warm and a cool. full red. And then we were allowed Viridian, and we did have a yellow. I want to say it was cad yellow, and then ultramarine blue, and then like ivory black and titanium. Like that was it. And then, as you paint, you just learn that you actually are limited sometimes by a limited palette. And I started realizing that, you can have like I try to have like a warm and a cool of each color essentially on my palette. And it just allows you like a greater vocabulary for your painting. Because I remember, working with that limited palette in college and like trying to create like a certain purple. And if you only have ultramarine blue and, alizarin, like you can only get like a certain purple. And I'd be like, what is wrong? Like, what? Like, I've mixed this a thousand times. And it's like, oh, like this blue isn't cold enough. Like, try this one. And then it was like, oh, well, there you go. And like, now I can get my color. Or like, I actually had to paint something that was hot pink. I'm currently doing a series of paintings of strong women, and this lady had like a hot pink sports bra on, and I really wanted to get that pop of color. And literally, I spent all day working with quinacridone rose, cad red, alizarin, and I'm trying to mix it in all different ways. And I'm like beating my head against the wall because I cannot create like the pink that I want. And then in comes Michael Harding to save the day with magenta. You guys, I'm telling you, magenta, Michael Harding, if you need hot pink, that's your color, But I just think like you learn like basic. I was grateful for the basic color education in college and having a limited palette, because I think color can be overwhelming. And so when you have a limited palette, it's just like, I think one of the most basic ways I've heard color theory discussed was Casey Ma, a famous figurative painter here in the United States. And he was like, color theory is not that hard. He's like, you just mix a color and then you ask yourself, does it need more red, yellow, or blue? And then you just add more red, yellow, or blue. And then, you add it. And then if it's still not right, you say, okay, does it need more red, yellow, or blue? And so I think it's good to start with like that basic. But then, yeah, like over time, you learn that a limited palette does have limitations. And so you think, oh, well, I'm going to add in some other colors. And then I have a broader spectrum. So,
That's true. So many insights. It's perfect for this podcast or what you're offering. It's fantastic. And
oh,
I was
thanks.
interested with how you said you were allowed certain colors in school, and it made me wonder, what rules do you keep currently for yourself that you won't break?
I don't have many rules, Simon. I've heard artists say like, don't ever use black. Guess what? I've used black. I'm such a rebel. What rules don't I break?
Some artists will say, I won't use a straight edge because it's not organic enough and it seems cold, or some
I'll
artists
use a straight edge too.
use a
You know
straight.
what? This is okay. I'm gonna just tell you real quick, Simon. I was trained as an illustrator. Okay, like I went to school to be a children's book illustrator. That's what I thought my profession was going to be. I only became a fine artist by default because I realized that that whole world was trending digital, and I just didn't knew I did not want to paint on a computer for my job. So, but I think as being trained as an illustrator, you are trained very scrappy, Like we don't put on airs like, oh, I'll never use a ruler, or like I would never use a grid to do my drawing. That's just like cheating. Or like I would never use black in a painting because black just, we don't like I feel like in the illustration world, we're like, no, we have a job, we need to get the job done, we've got a week to get it done, and we're gonna use whatever tools or means we can use to get there. So I feel like coming from like the scrappy illustration background, I don't have very many rules. Except I think one thing that I've just learned over time is if I'm gonna do a high key painting, like I'm currently working on with this light bulb, don't paint it on top of another piece. Because I actually will, if I don't like a piece, I'll paint over it. And I had this painting that was very dark. It was all drawn in like raw umber, really deep brown. And I was going to do this portrait, and then I didn't like it, and I was going to scrap it. And then on top of that, I was going to paint this very light beach scene. And like, dude, I'm telling you, I've put like 3 layers of paint on that freaking canvas, and I'm just gonna have to light it on fire one of these days or something, because it's crazy. And this is what I think goes back to like Bill Whitaker telling me to start with color and you can always subdue it. Like that underlying brown is still there. Like somehow, like I see it like through all these layers of light blue and pink, that I try to put on top of it. So I've just tried to become a little more careful, like surface wise. Like if you're going to start something light, like make sure that the underpainting is going to be conducive to that.
That's a great
And
tip.
like the only rule I can really think of right now.
So, do you not start with a ground color?
It depends on the painting. So I have on some pieces, but like, see how high key this one is?
Mm.
This one I just started not with a ground color. I started with the white canvas. Oh, and this is a topic that I love to talk about, actually. And this is simultaneous contrast, which is the arch nemesis of all painters, right? Oh, you start on a white canvas. Oh my gosh, every color that you put down is going to look darker than it really is. You're going to finish your whole first layer and you're going to think, well, that's all too light, right? And so then you think, oh, I got you. I got you simultaneous contrast. I'm going to start with a level 5 gray background. And then all the values that I put down are going to be accurate, right? Well, I did that. And then I stood back and I said, congratulations, you have a great painting. Because now, your simultaneous contrast is not against black and white, it's against color, right? Like every color that I put down looks so saturated because I'm comparing it visually to gray, right? So then your first layer is like, okay, well, there's no color on that painting, we're gonna have to try again. And so I feel like simultaneous contrast is the bane of my existence that I continue to try to like find my way around, because if you start on a toned canvas, it's burnt sienna, like a really warm color. Every color that you put down is going to look ice cold, right? Oh, so it's so frustrating. I don't really know what the answer is, but I will say that I kind of have started painting on panels that are like every color. And I don't know if it's the answer, Simon. I really don't know, but I enjoy it. So I'll show you. So I get these wood panels. Oh my gosh, I love talking shop so much. Like I haven't been on very many podcasts where you just talk shop, okay? So this is like your typical birch panel, okay? Then I get a piece of not linen. This is actually muslin, okay? It's like cotton, cheap fabric. I was actually taught this by Doug Fryer, who is a very well-known Utah landscape painter, okay? He takes this and he'll layer his birch with thick gesso, and then he puts this on top of it, and the gesso, it comes through the fabric, right? And it adheres the fabric onto the panel. And then you're left with something like this, okay? And if you look, you can see like where it was, the fabric is like folded over on the corners. And so you get like a little bit of like a tooth, but way less than canvas. It's like very, very, very fine, which is great for portraiture, right? But I don't like working on white canvases. So then what do we do? Well, then we get that. And I'll paint a whole bunch of colors on it.
Look quite dark as
Because,
well, just for the audio listeners.
yeah,
Look at this
well,
dark
yeah,
midtone.
I mean, I kind of got you in shadow. It's probably like a level 5, honestly. It's probably about a mid-tone.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
But I put a bunch of color on it. I let it dry and then I sand it off. So this has been sanded, so you can see like all the marks. It's
Yeah,
really
it's nice.
interesting because, you get all this visual texture, but it's just like smooth, like a baby's butt. And this is like my current like favorite surface to work on, just because I like the color variety and the texture variety. when I'm getting started. And I just feel like I'm going to deal with simultaneous contrast, like no matter what, but by having like a more, I don't know, like playful beginning somehow. And I feel like I also like to sand back, you know, so I like having this underneath. So I do that scraping, but sometimes you need to say more with texture. And so it offers you kind of like this peekaboo that if you want to, you could remove some oil paint and let some things like, you know, show. So
Do you do workshops?
anyways.
Do you teach yourself? Because it seems like you'd be a fantastic teacher.
Yes, I typically teach like four workshops a year. But I'm not this year because I am hosting a conference for 500 women.
Wow.
And I'm just telling you right now, I never thought that I would be organizing a conference, and it is a considerable amount of work. And so I'm not teaching. I do teach online through Patreon, but it's, you know, with my Patreon account, I've got like, oh my gosh, like maybe 60 videos. And I just do a video a month where I go over some topic and post it. So, you know, it's only like $10 or whatever, but I do have that's kind of ongoing. But as far as in person, I won't be teaching in person again until 2026. So,
Well, it's a treat
yeah.
to have you talk to us because you can see how naturally you do share this information. It's wonderful. Now, sadly, we're going to have
Oh,
to
thanks.
start wrapping up. So the last question that I normally ask people, or one of the last, is what has your experience been with galleries? Have you had a great experience, a mixed experience, bad experiences? What's it been like for you?
Well, Simon, I've just kind of realized that I don't think I'm not a gallery painter, you know? And not that I have sold work in galleries, but this is the thing. I think because I did the art journaling thing, all of my paintings continue to be like a piece out of my art, like a page out of my art journal. You know, like I've painted grief and I've painted hope and I've painted faith and now I'm painting strong women because I do American Ninja Warrior, and I feel like because they're so personal, they have a hard like it's hard for a gallery rep to sell them. Like I've just learned that I'm actually my best salesman because I'm the one that knows the story, you know, that can share why I painted it the best. And I think because of that, I'm not like the best fit for galleries. Now, I mean, occasionally I'll do a piece that's generic enough that it will sell well in a gallery, but now I've built an online following enough that like somebody will just buy it off my Instagram, you know? And so I feel like for me, it's not a good fit. So I bought this studio in 2020. Prior to 2020, I was just painting in my basement. And then when I finally had this space, I told my husband, I was like, I'm going to take all of my art out of the galleries and just put it in my studio and then just self-represent my art. I know some artists, it's really hard for them to be the salesman or talk about their art, you know, but for me, it just naturally is like a part of the gig. So yeah, I'm not actually represented by any galleries right now because the other thing, dude, other thing, the way I paint is like so time intensive, like, you know, 100 hours on a painting or whatever. And then the gallery wants half. And I just am like, I'm not willing to give it because I just feel like in today's marketing world of art, I am marketing myself online. I have like an email following, I have a social media following, I have a Patreon following. And so it's like, what am I really paying them for? You know, like if I did a gallery show, I would be the one to tell all of my followers, I'm going to be at this gallery, they're going to have my art, you know, and like, is it really worth half? You know, especially if it's like a, you know, if it's like a $20,000 painting, I mean, I'm paying them $10,000 to put that on their wall. That's a lot of money to put it on the wall, you know?
No, I
So
completely agree.
I know galleries do wonderful things for a lot of artists, but that's just my hot take.
No, I appreciate that. That is good rationality. The one thing that I do think is lost is that the privilege of seeing people's work in person is just unmatched by through the screen. Although commercially it
It's
works
true.
better for a lot of artists, and I'm not one to try and redress the balance to the galleries because I can understand how much freedom it gives the artist and independence to have that control over the marketplace with their work instead of the weird dynamic that artists have with galleries. Although not all galleries are equal. That's why it's an
Right.
interesting.
That's true. Yeah, I do have a gallery here in Utah that is owned by an artist named Kirk Richards. And whenever he does gallery shows, he does a 60-40, which I really appreciate. He'll actually give the artist more than the gallery takes. Same with our local museum here. We have a museum called the Springville Museum that's pretty well respected, and they do that as well. So I have shown in both of those places too.
Okay, so that's worth because I like to make sure that the audience is aware of where they can see your work in person. So they'll be linked in the description, so that people, if you do have any exhibitions on, can check the websites and check your social media to see when that will be because
But you know what? I also would let any like I also do private tours at my studio. So if anybody was like, "Oh my gosh, like I'm in Utah and I would love to come see your work," like they can set up an appointment. I mean, it is by appointment, but I've taken a lot of people through and they can see all of it. So
that's
that's
amazing.
available too.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, that'll be through your Instagram and your website. Is that the way people reach out to you? Yeah.
So I'm just my name, Jenity Page on Instagram, and my website is just jenitypage.com.
Fantastic. Is there any other social media which you'd like people to go to support you and see your work? Are you on any other platforms?
Well, I do Patreon, so if anybody out there is on Patreon, you can find me on there. And then also I have a YouTube channel that's Jenity Page Art.
Excellent. Well, that'll all be linked in the description of the audio platforms and the video. You've been incredibly generous with your time. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Sure. Thanks, Simon.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that episode. If you can support the podcast by leaving a like or a comment down below, that'd really be great. But what we'd really like is if you're able to leave a review on the podcast channels, wherever you listen to it or download it, because that helps us get spread around the internet so that more people have access to us and able to see what we're making.
Also, follow us on Instagram, and we'd really appreciate it if you like and engage with our posts. Help get the podcast better known. Thanks for listening.